Now it's a great pleasure to introduce Professor Trevor Hussey, who's one of the founder members of the PhilSoc. He was here in Tony Chadwick's time. He marks the Chadwick essays for us. We're very grateful. He's been teaching philosophy at Bucks University for 20, 30 years. And he's taught in the department. He started me on philosophy in the days when we were both a lot younger than we are now. He started Peter Gibson on philosophy. So a lot of us are very grateful to him. Okay, and short intro to empiricism.
Well, thank you very much. The first duty is to pay a compliment to Irene. I think we all ought to give a round of applause for handing up on this. Well, thank you very much for inviting me into the meal this evening. I had 15 minutes, so I've now got about 7, so I'm going to have to skate through this very fast, because I've been asked to stress to people, please keep within your time slot. So I will try and do that with this. All I'm going to do is introduce empiricism in a very low-level way. I'm not going to say anything very profound at all. The central idea of empiricism, as you know, can everybody hear, by the way? The central idea in empiricism is that our knowledge and understanding of the world rests ultimately on sense experience. Now, put boldly like that, it seems mere common sense. How else would you discover, say, that oak trees have green leaves, apart from looking at them? It's only when we try to put this more precisely that the complications and the problems arise, and I'm going to give a very brief sketch of some of them. Some people have identified two main kinds of empiricism. One has to do with knowledge and beliefs, the other to do with concepts. The claim about knowledge and beliefs is that they are derived from sense experience, and they're assembled by intergeneralizations, by association, and by induction, and so forth. And the other claim is that concepts are derived by sense experience. Now, the first of those, you'll recognise the one about knowledge, is opposed to the traditional rationalist view that the claim that our knowledge is in some way derived from reason, and that knowledge of the world is, in the end, a deductive system, rather like Euclidean geometry. The second view about concepts is opposed to the rationalist thesis that we're equipped with innate ideas. So there's been a battle going on about that ever since empiricism was invented. Well, since knowledge and belief is very difficult to see how we could have knowledge and belief without concepts, I'm going to run the two together and just stick with my original definition and say that empiricism is the thesis that our knowledge and our beliefs and understanding of the world rests on or is derived from sense experience. More technically, knowledge of the world is a posteriori, not a priori. Okay. Now, there's a huge amount of philosophy that's revolved around defending and attacking and developing empiricism, certainly since John Locke. Now, I'll confine myself to just sketching three main streams of debate that have come out of this conflict. One, justification; the second, process; and the third is logic and language. So the first one is justification. Now, if the empiricist is right and we can gain knowledge from sense experience, then we must be able to justify our claims to knowledge, because knowledge expressed in propositions has to be true. You can't know falsehoods. So therefore, if you're claiming you can gain knowledge from sense experience, you have to be able to justify that your knowledge is your knowledge of truths. Now, this, of course, we could say more broadly that our picture of the world, if it's going to be accurate, has to correspond to the world, how the world really is. Now, this is where the skeptic steps in, and it's also familiar stuff that I'm sure you'll be familiar with it. But the skeptic steps in, and the empiricist has to face a barrage of arguments about dreams, hallucinations, illusions, etc., etc., all these typical skeptical arguments. Now, it's tempting to respond by saying, well, look, if you doubt your eyes, when they tell you that oak trees have green leaves, then just take another look. But of course the problem is that our errors may be systematic, and they may let us down. What lets us down once can always let us down. That's the traditional argument. And this struggle with scepticism continues to this day. Now, I don't know what the speakers are going to be talking about, so I can't tell you whether they're going to take up these sceptical arguments, but they're certainly still real. One popular response has been to try to find something that is certain and immune from the sceptics' criticisms, and the best known candidate for that, as you probably know, is sense data. Now, we may not know that there is greenness out there in the oak tree, but we can be sure that we have a green sense datum in our minds, in our consciousness. The trouble is, of course, that if the sense data are features of our consciousness, then we can't know, how do we know that they correspond to anything in the world? And if we say no sense data are out there in the world, then how do we know that our perception of them is correct? So the case goes on, the argument goes on. And how certain can sense data be? To use an old example, if I'm looking at a speckled hen, I mean, the claim is that sense data are certain and simple. That's why they're introduced, to be something certain and simple. Well, if I'm looking at a speckled hen, do I have one complex sense datum with an indefinable number of speckles, or do I have an indefinite number of simple speckled sense data? You've got to go one way or the other, and neither seems satisfactory. So there are still problems about the justification of the claim that we can gain knowledge and beliefs from sense experience. Let's pass on to process now. It's both a philosophical and a psychological problem, in fact. If we gain knowledge and all concepts from our sense experience, how do we do it? What process is involved in gaining this knowledge? John Locke used the analogy of the mind as a sheet of white paper. But if I hold up a sheet of white paper to the world, it doesn't seem to learn very much. So how do we do it if our minds are just blank sheets? Well, suppose a child is learning a concept, say the concept of a teacup. And its mother points to a teacup and says, "That is a teacup." She then points to another teacup and says, "That is a teacup." And she continues that ritual until the child can do the same. Well, a simple picture, and it appears to work in practice. But how? On the empiricist view, how does it work? First, as Wittgenstein argues, we are assuming that the child understands the ritual of pointing and naming. Now, a blank sheet of paper doesn't know what a name is, and it doesn't understand pointing, so how do we? Second, how does the child pick out the teacup from the rest of the table, the rest of the room, or the rest of the universe? How does it do it? And how does a child notice that the next piece of pointing goes to a similar thing, a similar teacup? Does the empiricist have to admit that in order to form a concept of, say, a teacup, the child must already have concepts of difference and sameness? At the very least, it's got to start with that. And isn't this saying that the rationalist is right when he claims that we are innately furnished with the means of learning? This is essentially what Chomsky is saying, which I think one of the speakers is going to talk about. Now, even if this story were true, how exactly do we use these concepts that we get from experience? To use another Wittgensteinian example, suppose we send a child out into the garden and we say to the child, "Go and pick a blue flower." Now, the child goes out equipped with its concept of blueness. It's like an internal conscious colour sample lodged in its mind. And it wanders about, toddles about the garden until it finds something which corresponds to that blue colour. It picks it, comes in triumphantly, proudly carrying a blue flower. But wait a minute. How did the child pick the right colour sample? It's got a lot of them. It knows red and blue and green and all the rest of it. How did it pick the blue one? And if it could pick the blue colour sample in its consciousness, why can't it just walk up to a blue flower and pick that? What function is this internal concept doing? So, does this stem from the empiricist accepting a rather dubious distinction between the external world and the internal conscious mind? Is that underlying empiricism? Lots of people have criticised it for holding that view. Now, even if we resolve those problems about how we learn concepts of teacups and so on, what about abstract concepts? How do you achieve the concept of liberty or beauty? Or what about mathematical concepts like square roots and infinity and a mathematical point? I mean, have you ever seen or touched or smelt a square root? And yet somehow you've got the concept. When you come to moral concepts, there's another tricky question. Do we obtain our concepts of goodness and badness by seeing good and bad acts out there in the world? And if we do, how does that overcome the naturalistic fallacy that you can't get an ought from an is? Because our concepts of good and bad are oughts. What you see out there is a fact. So how's it done? Okay, that's enough about process. Lastly, logic and learning. Sorry, logic and language. If all our knowledge of the world is obtained by sense experience, then surely the propositions we express it in are a posteriori and contingently true. The truth depends on how the world happens to be. They're said to be synthetic. So empiricists from Hume to Bertrand Russell have claimed that only necessary and a priori truths, the only necessary a priori truths, are things like tautologies, mathematical statements, definitions, laws of logic. They tell us nothing about the world because their truth depends simply on the meanings of the words that the propositions contain. They're called analytic. Well, this neat picture known as Hume's fork has been challenged by many philosophers, as I'm sure you're all very aware, but I'll just go through a few of them. Immanuel Kant argued that some propositions are known a priori, and yet they tell us about the world. They're synthetic. If it's true, the rationalist has a foothold. John Stuart Mill took the opposite view. He claimed that all real propositions are empirical, including those of mathematics and logic. So empiricism is universal. There's no need for necessary truths, necessary a priori truths. Willard Van Orman Quine very famously challenged the distinction between analytic and synthetic propositions. He claimed that it simply should be abandoned. There's nothing sacred even about logical truths. Ultimately, a body of beliefs, you hold it against the world, and the truth of any proposition can be challenged, any proposition, including a logical law. Then Saul Kripke rejects empiricism because, he says, all necessary truths are not necessarily a priori. He argues that a priori truths are contingent. For example, the standard meter bar measures 1 meter is an example of an a priori truth, which is contingent. He says that some necessary truths are a posteriori. Water is H2O, and so on. So, I've gabbled through this very quickly to try and catch up time, but whether or not you want to call yourself empiricist, you have to accept that this philosophical thesis has been the birth of an enormous amount of philosophy. A great deal, it's been very fruitful and thought-provoking, and among both its friends and its enemies. So I'm sure, at least I hope, the rest of the 2 days you've got will be as fruitful. Thank you.